Take your Bibles with me now, if you will, and turn to James chapter 3. This morning we come to a paragraph in James that you might expect to find in the book of Proverbs or perhaps in the book of Ecclesiastes, but it is here at the end of this third chapter of James, and it really represents what is probably the key passage, if not the theme passage of this whole book, James chapter 3, verses 13 through 18. As you study the Bible, you soon discover that it presents to us basically two ways. They're variously described, but they are very distinct. And it is quite obvious that all people are on one path or the other. All people are in one way or the other. Those two ways are categorized as cursed or blessed, wicked or righteous, idolater or worshiper of the one true living God. Living in the fear of God, or there is no fear of God before their eyes. In and of the darkness, or in and of the light. Night people or day people. On the broad way that leads to death, or on the narrow way that leads to life. Foolish or wise, proud or humble, natural or spiritual, worldly or godly, in Adam or in Christ, unbeliever or believer, those who are perishing, those who are being saved. You get the idea. But two very distinct ways, two polar opposite paths, diametrically opposed to each other, producing two very different kinds of people with two very different attitudes, outlooks, perspectives, beliefs, values, and destinies. Moses was the first to make these two ways explicit. He exhorted the children of Israel to recognize these two ways and to choose wisely which way they would go. In Deuteronomy chapter 30, verse 15, he said, "See, I have set before you today life and prosperity and death and adversity, in that I command you today to love the Lord your God, to walk in his ways, to keep his commandments and his statutes and his judgments, that you may live and multiply, and that the Lord your God may bless you in the land where you are entering to possess it." He says, "I call heaven and earth to witness against you today that I have set before you life and death, the blessing and the curse." Those are the two options. So choose life in order that you may live, you and your descendants, by loving the Lord your God, obeying his voice, holding fast to him, for this is your life and the length of your days, that you may live in the land which the Lord your God swore to your fathers. Wisdom literature then sort of picks up on that motif and expands on it. The opening psalm, for example, Psalm chapter 1, considered a wisdom psalm, contrasts these two ways. "Blessed is the man who..." And then it lists certain characteristics. "Then the wicked are not so." And then other characteristics are given. The book of Proverbs majors on this contrast, relentlessly appealing to the young, the simple, the naive. "Do not go the way of fools. Pursue wisdom." Proverbs 1:8, "Hear, my son, your father's instruction, and do not forsake your mother's teaching. If sinners entice you, do not consent. Do not walk in the way with them. Keep your feet from their path. Wisdom shouts in the street. She lifts her voice in the square. She cries out, "How long, O naive ones, will you love being simple-minded? Turn to my reproof." Proverbs 2:1, "My son, if you will receive my words and treasure my commandments within you, make your ear attentive to wisdom, incline your heart to understanding. If you seek her as silver and search for her as for hidden treasures, then you will discern the fear of the Lord and discover the knowledge of God. For the Lord gives wisdom. From his mouth come knowledge and understanding." And then in Proverbs 3:13, "How blessed is the man who finds wisdom and the man who gains understanding, for her profit is better than the profit of silver and her gain better than fine gold. The curse of the Lord is on the house of the wicked, but he blesses the dwelling of the righteous. Though he scoffs at the scoffers, yet he gives grace to the afflicted. The wise will inherit honor, but fools display dishonor." And on and on it goes like that, extolling the virtues of wisdom and appealing to us, all of us, to prize wisdom, pursue wisdom above all things. Proverbs 9:6, "Forsake your folly and live and proceed in the way of understanding." Proverbs 4:7, "Acquire wisdom, and in all your acquiring, get understanding." Then in the New Testament, Jesus himself also likewise painted this picture of these two contrasting ways and urged everyone to enter through the narrow gate. "For the gate is wide and the way is broad that leads to destruction, and there are many who enter through it. But the gate is small and the way is narrow that leads to life, and there are few who find it." Paul expressed the same two divergent ways in 1 Corinthians, the contrast between the wisdom of this world, which is foolishness before God, and the wisdom of God, which is foolishness to the world. He said in 1 Corinthians 3:18, "Let no man deceive himself. If any man among you thinks that he is wise in this age, let him become foolish, that he may become wise. For the wisdom of this world is foolishness before God." In other words, very clearly, there is worldly wisdom, and there is heavenly wisdom. There are human philosophies, and there is divine revelation. There is a way which seems right to a man, but its end is death. And there is a way which is right and leads to life. But the two are antithetical to each other, and we must discern the difference between the two and seek and follow the way of true wisdom that leads to life. And we must honestly evaluate the fruit and the character of our lives to recognize which way we are in. That, I think, is the basic appeal James is making in this letter. There are two ways set before you. Which one are you in? There are two paths that all of us are on, one or the other. Which path are you on? And that recurring theme sort of reaches its zenith point here in our text. It finds expression in these words: "Who among you is wise and understanding? Let him show by his good behavior, his deeds in the gentleness of wisdom. But if you have bitter jealousy and selfish ambition in your heart, do not be arrogant and so lie against the truth. This wisdom is not that which comes down from above, but is earthly, natural, demonic. For where jealousy and selfish ambition exist, there's disorder and every evil thing. But the wisdom from above is first pure, then peaceable, gentle, reasonable, full of mercy and good fruits, unwavering, without hypocrisy. And the seed whose fruit is righteousness is sown in peace by those who make peace. There's the contrast. Very sharp, isn't it? Very clear. And it is the contrast of what? It is the contrast of two kinds of wisdom. There is a wisdom that comes down from above, and there is a wisdom that does not come down from above. There is true and godly and heavenly wisdom, and there is earthly, natural, even demonic wisdom. And so the question implied is, which one governs your life? Which one of these two kinds of wisdom defines your approach even to the Christian life? These are two very different ways of thinking, of living, with two very different results. Which one describes you? Now, you notice, first of all, this paragraph stands alone. It's sort of an independent passage, at least grammatically. There's no connecting particle or conjunction. And yet it's very easy to see the connection, isn't it? Especially to what immediately precedes. No one can tame the tongue. Why? What is our problem? We lack wisdom. Or many of you want to be teachers. You think you ought to be teachers, but are you wise and understanding? Let's look at your life. And so this becomes another test of maturity, another test, frankly, of true faith. Are you wise? Are you walking in the way of true biblical wisdom? Or are you still following the wisdom of this world? Are you still operating by the governing principles of the world, the flesh, the devil? Which way are you going? What does your life reveal? What do the ways and means, what do the motives and methods of your life reveal? The discussion, you'll notice, is introduced with a question and a challenge. The question, who among you is wise and understanding? The challenge, let him show by his good behavior, his deeds in the gentleness of wisdom. This interrogative approach with its personal appeal is aimed at the conscience of each and every one of his readers. And it isn't intended to imply that no one qualifies, that no one is wise and understanding, but it challenges to self-examination any who might rashly assume that they are. And to them, James says, don't tell us, show us. It's not who among you is wise and understanding. Let him say, let him speak. No, let him show. In other words, wisdom, just like faith, is known by its works, by its deeds, its conduct. It should be evident in your life. If nobody but you thinks you have it, then you probably don't. And you can see how this fits with the discussion on the tongue. Having a little trouble controlling your tongue? Here's an idea. Stop talking and start doing. You don't prove your wisdom by your words, but by your works. That would solve most of our problems with the tongue, wouldn't it? If we weren't allowed to say with our lips, we had to show with our life. So James is saying, let your attitudes and your actions speak for themselves. Because if you have to toot your own horn, then probably it isn't worth tooting. The two adjectives here, wise and understanding, actually appear together in the New Testament only here. It's the only place you see these two together. But in the Old Testament, they occur together frequently. They appear in Deuteronomy 1:13, for example, as the necessary qualifications of tribal leaders or judges in Israel. If you were going to be in leadership over the people, or if you were going to be ruling or judging, obviously you must be wise and understanding. But in Deuteronomy 4:6, Hosea 14:9, and other places, they are united together as desired qualities in all of God's people. Everyone was to be wise and understanding, not just rulers or judges or the elders of the people, but everyone. And everyone could be wise and understanding if they would be, because they had the knowledge of God. They had the revelation from God. They knew Him and His law and His ways. And that was the distinction between them and all the other nations. You can be wise and understanding because you have a God who is wise and understanding. Wise is the term sophos, sophisticated. In Jewish usage, it described the person who possessed moral insight, skill in deciding practical issues of life, of conduct, a wisdom derived from one's personal knowledge of God. Understanding, epistemon, refers to knowledge, true knowledge, real knowledge, deep insight. It was used of an expert or a specialist, someone who was able to apply his knowledge, his insight to practical situations. And so the two words are synonymous. There's no huge distinction intended by them. Knowledge, wisdom, insight. But not just intellectually, not just knowledge of information or facts, but the practical, moral, and spiritual insight to live wisely. Who among you has that? Who among you is wise and understanding? And before anyone can answer that rhetorical question, he gives the charge, let him show. Let him show. It's an aorist imperative. It calls for a demonstration. Show me! It's not show and tell, just show! Show us! Such wisdom is to be demonstrated. It is to be lived. And where it truly exists, it will be. And not by an eloquent speech, however articulate, however convincing, but by a good life. Let him show how? By his good behavior, his deeds in the gentleness of wisdom. This echoes the emphasis in Old Testament wisdom literature that knowing knowing is really measured by doing. If you didn't do, you didn't know. And that's the idea here. No need to tell me how wise and understanding you are. If you are, your life will tell me. We have a saying, us Aggies down in Aggieland, it's not the grades you make, it's the hands you shake. And James is saying here, it's not your degrees we're looking at. It's your deeds. Two words stand out there in verse 13. The word good behavior. It's the word that means qualitatively good, excellent, virtuous, beautiful, winsome. A battery, for example, can be good. Right? Is your battery good? Yeah, it's not dead. It's charged enough to power my device. But a battery can't be good in the sense of beautiful, winsome, attractive. That's the word here. Our behavior is to be that. The one who is wise and understanding will be known by his or her goodness. There will be a genuineness about their life that is winsome and attractive and appealing. Then there's also the word gentleness. His deeds in the gentleness of wisdom, which means what? It means that there is a gentleness about wisdom. There's a humility about it, a meekness, a mildness of manner, especially as it relates to dealing with other people. It's gentle, meaning it's not harsh, it's not abrasive, it's not assertive. There's an attitude of modesty, unobtrusiveness. Doug Moo puts it this way, this Christian meekness involves a healthy understanding of our own unworthiness before God and a corresponding humility and lack of pride in our dealings with our fellow men. That's right. So it's a gentleness in terms of our disposition toward other people that comes from a recognition of our humble standing before God. So with goodness, in gentleness, is how this wisdom is to show itself. But that's the question here. Who has that? Who has that? Do you have that? Is that what your life looks like? Is that what other people see? Is that what they would say? So that introduces this contrast. The contrast of these two ways and these two kinds of wisdom. Look at them. First, the boastful way of worldly wisdom. The boastful way of worldly wisdom. And notice, first of all, the character of it. Verse 14, but if you have bitter jealousy and selfish ambition in your heart. Or verse 16, where jealousy and selfish ambition exist. So clearly this wisdom, quote unquote wisdom, is characterized by those two things. Bitter jealousy and selfish ambition. And the "but if you have" implies that some of them did have. This was not a hypothetical thing. This was real. Some of you have bitter jealousy and selfish ambition in your heart. Now those are strong words, aren't they? And not good qualities to have. So it kind of makes you wonder what was going on in this congregation. Well, if we remember the context, we can kind of piece this together and make sense of it. These were Jewish Christians, right? Dispersed, scattered from Jerusalem, scattered from their homes by persecution. So they've endured all kinds of affliction, all kinds of hardship, all kinds of, many of them, suffering. Many of them are poor, especially now that they're kicked out of their homes, their jobs, and everything else. But probably all of them are eager for change. Eager for change in their circumstances, in their nation. Some of them may even have joined up with the cause of the zealots. Remember them? Jesus dealt with them in his ministry. One of his disciples came from that group, Simon the Zealot. That was a religious group within Israel that sought to bring about reform by force. Protests, violence, disruptions, terrorist activity, whatever means necessary. And their justification was what? Zeal. We're simply being zealous for the cause of God and His people. Israel is His chosen nation. God's glory is at stake here. God's people are at stake here. This is our land. We're being oppressed by Gentile rule. We need to fight for what is rightfully ours. And so they were motivated by zeal, religious zeal. That's the terminology James is using here. Zeal, jealousy, ambition. He says, look, I get it. You desire change. I understand that. You believe your cause is just. So it is. But the truth is, your motives are more selfish than they are pure. And your methods are more worldly than they are scriptural. So do not boast that what you're doing is sanctioned by God, inspired by heavenly wisdom, and so lie against the truth. So in other words, this is really a strong rebuke, I think, of that pseudo-Christian movement. The zealots, they were still alive and well. And this is a rebuke of that element, of that component within Jewish circles, predominantly within Jewish Christian circles even. And it's a good reminder to us that the anger of man does not accomplish the righteousness of God. Zeal for thy house has consumed me may be our battle cry. But whatever we may claim as our mission in this world, its true character is quickly exposed by our motives and our methods. Are you consumed with zeal for God's house, or are you just sick and tired of taxation without representation, right? Are you just sick and tired of big government? What's in your heart that's really driving you, that's making you so passionate about whatever it is you're so passionate about? Always check to make sure it isn't bitter jealousy or selfish ambition. Then notice, secondly, the source of this wisdom. Where does it come from? Verse 15, not from above. This wisdom is not that which comes down from above. What does that leave? Well, any and everything else. It comes from somewhere else, not from God, not from above. It comes then from below. It comes from the world, the flesh, the devil. It is earthly, meaning what? From this earthly realm. It springs out of and is limited by the frail and finite and fallen world. It is natural as opposed to supernatural, or unspiritual as opposed to spiritual, like the natural man who lives apart from God, is devoid of the Spirit of God, and cannot discern or understand spiritual things. So there's no supernatural component. There's no spiritual component to it. It is purely earthly and human and even demonic, of the devil, devilish. resembling or proceeding from an evil spirit. And that's the only other option, right? Your wisdom either comes from above, comes from God through divine revelation, or where else could it come from? Well, it could come from yourself, your own mind, your own imagination, or it could come from the world around you, the culture around you, human philosophies and so forth, that are all basically controlled by anti-God, anti-Christ world system, or from demons, or any combination of those three. But those are the only possibilities. That's why Paul in 1 Timothy 4:1 says the Spirit explicitly says that in later times some will fall away from the faith, paying attention to deceitful spirits and doctrines of demons. That's all there is. There is the faith, and there is deceitful spirits, doctrines of demons. Every false teaching comes ultimately from demons. That's why in chapter 4 here in this letter, James says, what is it, verse 4, chapter 4, verse 4, you adulteresses, do you not know that friendship with the world is what? Hostility toward God. The two are incompatible. Whoever wishes to be a friend of the world makes himself an enemy of God. That sounds like 1 John 2:15, doesn't it? Do not love the world, nor the things of the world. All that is of the world, the lust of the flesh, the lust of the eyes, the boastful pride of life, is not from the Father, but is from the world. So the question comes again, what happened? Right? What happened? How did these Jewish believers, these Jewish Christians become so worldly? How did they get true biblical wisdom confused with this kind of wisdom? Well, I think it's the same thing that happens in every age, in every generation of Christians. They were surrounded by a culture. They were influenced by that culture around them. Just like the Israelites in the Old Testament were Canaanized by the culture around them, the New Testament Jews and Jewish Christians were Hellenized by the culture around them. Greek culture, Greco-Roman culture, was the dominant influence in their world, and it worked. It influenced them. In Greek and Roman culture, there was a love of wisdom, philosophy. They were sophisticated people, cultured. They were into art and literature and all the things we associate, music, with culture, refinement, sophistication. But it was all the wisdom of this world. Paul sort of stepped in it, in the Mecca of it, in Acts chapter 17, when he arrived in Athens. And he even in Corinth, dealt with it. That's why in 1 Corinthians 2, he explained to them, when I came to you, brethren, I did not come with superiority of speech or of wisdom like Greek philosophers do, proclaiming to you the testimony of God. For I determined to know nothing among you except Jesus Christ and Him crucified. And I was with you in weakness and in fear and in much trembling. And my message and my preaching were not in persuasive words of wisdom, but in demonstration of the Spirit and of power. Why? So that your faith should not rest on the wisdom of men, but on the power of God. That very thing, I think, is what James is confronting still with his readers. That same wisdom. These Jewish Christians were so Hellenized by their Greek culture that they had confused the wisdom of this world and the wisdom from above. And James is reminding them that they are not the same thing. Two completely different animals, different character, different source. Different results. Notice the results, verse 16, for where jealousy and selfish ambition exist, there is what? Disorder and every evil thing. That's how you know this wisdom is not from above, right? Look at its effects. Look at what it yields. It yields disorder. What is that? Chaos. Anarchy. And all sorts of evil things. By contrast, that's the boastful way of worldly wisdom. By contrast, look at the beautiful way of heavenly wisdom. What is its source? Verse 17. But the wisdom from where? From above. True wisdom comes from above. It doesn't come from inside of you. It doesn't come from the world around you. It comes from above you. It comes from God. His revelation. He must reveal this wisdom or we would never know it. It's a gift. God must give it. It comes down from above. What is its character? Well, it is first pure. Pure, meaning what? Meaning pure, meaning clean, meaning undefiled, meaning free from impurity, free from impure motives, free from vice, like bitter jealousy and selfish ambition. Pure from that. It is peaceable. In other words, it desires peace and fosters peace. It promotes right relationships between people and people and people and God. Gentle, which again conveys the idea of just respectful consideration for the feelings of others. It is reasonable, which means teachable, really. Submissive, cooperative. It has the idea of being easily convinced, easily persuaded. You're not so stubborn, you're not so hard-headed, you're not so set in your ways that you can't entertain viewpoints from other people. It's reasonable. It's full of mercy or compassion and good fruits, which are the inevitable result of mercy and compassion. It's unwavering, which can also be translated impartial. It's without partiality. And it's without hypocrisy. Sincere. Genuine. Free from all pretense. It doesn't need to work behind a mask because it doesn't have anything to hide. And the results of this wisdom from above, verse 18, and the seed whose fruit is righteousness is sown in peace by those who make peace. Kind of a strange sentence and hard to translate, honestly. But what's the harvest? Righteousness. Who reaps that harvest? The ones who sow it. Peacemakers. So that's the idea. It just involves those two things. Being a peacemaker. And it involves righteousness. Those are the results. Those are the products, the yield that flows continually from this wisdom that comes from God. That's a pretty sharp, stark contrast, isn't it? Those two results. Think about that. Think about the contrast at the end of verse 18 and the end of verse 16. The contrast of disorder and every evil thing and peace and righteousness. And then look at your life and say, which one do I have? What do I see in my life? Disorder, every evil thing, or peace and righteousness? Which one do you have in your life? Which one are you sowing in the soil around you? We reap what we sow is the idea, and we don't reap what we don't sow. D. Edmund Hebert writes, "Those that make peace identifies the sowers by their characteristic activity. No official status is required to engage in this activity. They are peaceful themselves, but they also practice promoting peaceful relations between others. Motivated by this heavenly wisdom, they aim at reconciling quarrels and bringing men into peaceful relations with each other as brothers. In so doing, they themselves share in the blessings of the peace and fellowship that they promote." End quote. Peacemakers reap righteousness. You know, what hits me from this is I've had now, two or three or four weeks to study this, but the application that comes into my own way of thinking is that everybody wants change. Everybody wants change in something. There's always something we want change, right? We want change in society. We want change in our government. We want change in our culture. We want change in the church. We're constantly pursuing change, thinking about things that ought to change and how they need to change and what's the best way to make them change. And we want to change our kids. We want to change our spouse. We want to change our job, our boss, our income. It just goes on and on. The thing that this caused me to reflect on, though, is the question, why? Why? Whenever there's something that you're thinking about, that needs to change. I want this changed. To just stop and ask yourself, why? Why do I want it to change? What are your motives? And then what methods are you willing to employ to generate that change? I think the point here is the answer to those questions will reveal what kind of wisdom you're operating by. What kind of wisdom truly governs your life? So which way are you in? Which path are you on? There are only these two. If you are truly wise and understanding, it'll show. It'll show by your goodness and gentleness. I mean, peace and righteousness are kind of hard to miss in this world, right? If you are not so wise and understanding, question, what are you doing about it? Do you want to be wise? Do you know how to be? The Bible tells us 5 things. Number one, if you're going to be wise, you have to want to be. You have to seek to be. Proverbs 2:4, if you seek her as silver and search for her as for hidden treasures, then you will discern the fear of the Lord and discover the knowledge of God, for the Lord gives wisdom. From his mouth come knowledge and understanding. Wisdom is available, but you have to want it like it's the most valuable thing in the world to you. Secondly, you must study the Bible. Proverbs 19:7, the law of the Lord is perfect, reviving the soul. The testimony of the Lord is sure, making wise the simple. How do the simple get wise? You have to study and meditate on the Scriptures. There's no substitute for that. There's no shortcut around that. The wisdom of God comes down to us through His Word, and you must get in it, and it must get in you. You will never be wise otherwise. Three, you must pray for this wisdom. We've already covered that. James 1:5, if any of you lacks wisdom, let him ask of God, who gives to all generously and without reproach, and it will be given to him. What a verse. What a powerful verse. What a promising verse. You don't have it. You need it. God has it. Ask. Four, I think to get wisdom, you need to think about something you don't like to think about. What is it? Death. Proverbs 90:12. Teach us to number our days that we may gain a heart of wisdom. That's interesting, isn't it? What is Moses saying there? He's saying, thinking frequently about the brevity of your life and the inevitability of your death makes you wise. John Piper says, there's scarcely any thought that will purge our priorities of vain and worldly perceptions like the thought of our imminent death. Oh, how cleansing it is to ponder the kind of life we would like to look back on when we come to die. There's great wisdom in such meditation. Therefore, think often of your dying. So we have to seek it, we have to study for it, we have to pray for it, we have to think often of death. And then fifthly and ultimately, if you would be wise, you must come to Christ. You must come to Jesus. He is the wisdom of God, 1 Corinthians 1:24, 1 Corinthians 1:30. He is to us wisdom from God. Colossians 2:3, in Him are hidden all the treasures of wisdom and knowledge. Others have spoken truth. He is the truth. Others have pointed to the way. He is the way. Come to Christ. And then God's wisdom, along with its fruit of righteousness and peace, will come to you. Our prayer room out the back, down the hall to the right, is open if we can help you and pray with you about that. Father, we all see ourselves in this description. The problem is, if we're honest, we see a little of ourselves in each of these. In each of these. We too are influenced by the culture around us. We too are far more worldly minded than we'd like to admit. The fruit of our life reveals the truth. We can't deny it. May we not be arrogant and lie against that truth, but be humble and teachable and repentant and diligent to open your word and let it wash, let it renew, let it reform, transform not just our thinking, but our living. And may we come to Christ, not just once, but constantly, daily, repeatedly. Come to Christ and cling to Him and depend on Him
for the wisdom and the peace and the righteousness that only He can give. We pray this in His name and for His sake. Amen.